Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In a few minutes, we're going to be discussing the history of the horse. But first, what does the future hold for San Antonio's downtown horses of those carriage rides? The city of San Antonio is considering a ban on the downtown horse-drawn carriages. Currently, the city is surveying residents, tourists, and business owners to understand how they feel about the carriage operating downtown. We're joined by Stephanie Garcia, the owner of two horse-drawn carriages companies, Yellow Rose and HRH. And Stephanie Garcia, welcome to The Source.
Hello, thank you.
So what's being proposed right now? What do you see is happening with the city of San Antonio? What are they offering you?
At the moment, nothing. We have put some suggestions forward so that we could actually work with the city to compromise. We did this several months ago, but we've actually had no response back from the city at all.
What is the city telling you why they want the, or why they're thinking about removing the horses from downtown? What are their concerns?
It changes. Originally, when the CCR was filed in November 2022, it was cruelty and that the horses weren't looked after. And then it changed to congestion. And I believe the latest one is public safety.
Do you understand anything about why public safety? Has there ever been a problem?
There's never been a problem. We've had no incidents downtown. One of the comments that was made regarding the public safety was that we couldn't get out of the way of emergency vehicles downtown. Obviously, our companies have been down there since the early 80s. Our horses are trained for situations like that. They actually do respond to emergency vehicles faster than most car drivers and actually do hear the sirens before the driver generally. So they know that they've got to get out of the way of the emergency vehicle.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to call me really quickly, because this is just for this first segment about the horse-drawn carriages you've got to take, give me a call, 833-877-8255. So right now, Stephanie, extremely hot, over 100 degrees during the daytime. The night doesn't really cool off. What are you doing to make sure that the horses aren't overtaxed?
So we are actually regulated by a very strict ordinance that's set by the city. We do not work when it's above 95 or above. So for the last week, we've actually not been working several of the nights. So if the temperature does go up above that, I mean, there's been comments that Texas summers are getting hotter. It doesn't make any difference. We still don't work. As soon as it hits 95, the horses are not out there. And we are regulated by a certain weather station that the city tell us that we have to work from. So it's not just any willy-nilly sort of weather station that we go by. It's one that is set by the city.
And have you been sitting down? I know there have been certain city council members who are very vocal about their opposition to the horses. They want them removed entirely. Have you sat down with them and heard why they want that?
We've tried to get meetings. We have spoken to several of them now in the last couple of months, but they don't give us definite answers. They don't tell us exactly why they want rid of us. Like I say, it changes every time. This original CCR was the second signature on that was Phyllis Villagran, and she's actually done a full 180, and she's in support of the businesses now. So she's actually in support of the horse carriages staying in the downtown area. We've got a unanimous vote from the TAB, which is the Transportation Advisory Board, that they want to work with us and keep right. The horses downtown San Antonio.
I'm going to go to a caller. We have Robert on the line. And Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. My name is Robert Gonzalez. I'm a member of the Transportation Advisory Board. They went before our board, and the board voted unanimously for the city to work with them so they can stay in business. They're little businesses that have been providing the city a great service for many years. The ground transportation office that regulates us doesn't have any complaints against them. They're good operators. I have looked into this, There's no public safety complaints. They take care of the forces very well. I think they're an asset to our city, and I hope that the city council and the mayor works with these small operators, these small businesses, so they can stay in business. I think it's the right thing because they have provided excellent service.
Right. Robert, thank you so much for calling, and we appreciate you weighing in on that. Stephanie Garcia, there is a survey out right now. Tomorrow is the cutoff date where people can, voice their opinion. We have a link to that survey on our website at tpr.org. Do you think this survey is going to decide whether or not the horse-drawn carriages are going to be able to continue in San Antonio, or is this just part of the process?
I would have wished that they would have done a scientific survey, because at the moment this survey is being just passed out to everybody. I know that there's been a lot of influences from the animal activists that have been pushing this survey from all over the country. So it's not a scientific survey at all, and it's not really going to give a good result as to what the people of San Antonio actually feel about the horses.
So if the animal rights people, do you think they're the ones that are driving the conversation to remove the horse-drawn carriages?
Yes, definitely. I mean, and it's not even people from Texas. These animal activist groups are coming from Chicago and New York. They've openly admitted that if they can shut down the horse carriages in San Antonio, that is just the start, and they will be able to go on to every horse carriage company in the country and shut them down.
And what is their concern? I mean, according to the records with the veterinarians that service you guys, there is no record of any abuse or horses.
The horses are in the emissions. Most vehicles now have less emissions than 40 years ago when these companies started. But also there is no scientific evidence of any horse from working in a downtown environment having lung disease, any type of lung disease, or any sort of problems from working in that environment.
What do you think the horse-drawn carriages mean to San Antonio's heritage as a Western town, Stephanie?
It's part of San Antonio's history. Horse and carriages have been around since 1865 in San Antonio. The horses are ambassadors for San Antonio. People come from all over the world for the Alamo, for the horses, for the cowboys. This is what they want to see. And sometimes some of these children, these are the only interaction that they get with these beautiful creatures.
Do you think if they go to the horse-drawn carriages, they remove them? Rodeo horses,
rodeo, it's all next. Part. They'll be all working horses. They will go after every possible working animal. We still have the mounted sections. We still have the dog sections for the police. You know, what's the difference? They can't just stop at us. They will continue. It will be the rodeo. It will be the trail rides. It will be every working animal.
Stephanie Garcia is the owner of the horse-drawn carriage company Yellow Rose. They operate in downtown San Antonio. We have a link to the survey on our website, tpr.org. Stephanie Garcia, thank you so much. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about the history of the horse when we come back. Stay with us. On a dark flat land she rides. On a pony she named Wildfire. Whirlwind by her side.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at JinguHouseSATX.com. Se murió mi amigo Bronco. Se fue a ver qué hay más allá. Siempre fue el caballo más atrevido. Bronco a más. Se rompieron sus tobillos. Yo lo tuve que acabar.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the history of the horse. We're going to play some horse songs in our breaks, coming in and out of the breaks. And That is Bronco, if you recognize that. Where would we be without the horse, without that marvelous beast of burden, companion of the trail? How did we end up with the horse, and how did it shape civilization? How did humanity shape the horse that we know? Timothy Weingard is the author of 6 books, including his latest. It's The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. And Timothy Weingard, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me.
I wonder if I could just get you to weigh in on, you can't really talk about San Antonio's horse-drawn carriages situation, but this is happening across the country, New York, Chicago, other major cities banning horse-drawn carriages. Have you looked into that? What do you see there?
Yeah, I think there's 2 sides to it, but as your last guest said, they're being treated humanely, and they are part of American culture and Americana. And as long as they're being treated humanely and under proper working conditions, they are a piece of Central Park in New York City or New Orleans. When I was there last Thanksgiving, there's, the horse carriage rides through the French Quarter and in San Antonio, as the prior guest mentioned in your last little segment. So, we've had the horse for 5,500 years as a beast of burden, and we've used it for literally every facet of humanity possible. And our history is a shared history with the horse. And I think that's why there's still a connection, this strong connection and feelings that we have towards this animal.
Do you think we'd lose something if we removed the horse from public interaction, like these carriages?
The world's changing so rapidly with technology and AI and computers and everything else. I think it kind of grounds us to what it means to be human. And we share a very close relationship with horses, probably as close as any other animals, save perhaps for dogs. And I think, it's important to hang on to some of our past and remember where we come from. And it's important to realize just how indispensable this animal was to our, foundations of civilization since its domestication. And there's still 58 million horses on the planet today. It's the 9th most abundant animal. And it's used, as your last segment alluded to, whether it's rodeo, equestrian sports. And again, to the point, if the horses are being treated humanely and looked after and given medical attention when necessary, I don't see a reason why they shouldn't be available for rodeos or sport, recreational trail riding as pets, and certainly to pull carriages for tourists who, as your last guest said, this might be the only interaction that they ever get with these magnificent animals.
Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've got a question about the history of a horse, what is your relationship to horses? How much do you value them? How do they contribute to your life? I'd love to hear your story. 833-877-8255. Well, let's talk about the earliest art or impression of humanity and the cave walls found in France and places like that, where there are these early paintings of horses. Even before we really had civilization, there was some fascination that early man had with the horse. And that horse, not the same horse that we have today, but what was happening? What do we see? What was happening there?
So the earliest artistic evidence left by Homo sapiens roughly 32,000 years ago is the oldest cave paintings in Chevet Cave in France. The Lascaux Cave, the more famous one, which is actually a little bit newer, has horses. So there's caves dotted throughout primarily Spain and France, but also in other parts of Europe and the Eurasian steppe, Ukraine, Mongolia, that depict, the animals that humans regularly hunted. So the horse was hunted for food, just along with all other animals. By our early hominid ancestors in Africa, we're hunting zebras and asses, and certainly our Homo sapien ancestors were hunting horses across Eurasia. So we see these depictions of horses doing all kinds of things in cave paintings, from fornicating to galloping to grazing. So they were really some of the first, in a way, animal biologists as well, because they have an innate relationship and a very intimate relationship, with these animals through observing them and hunting them.
looking at the biological record or genetics, how different are those early horses to what we have today?
So the early horses in Europe, it's the tarpan, which resembles, so there's only one species of horse, Equus calabus. All other horse species have died off, save for the Przewalski's horse, which is most likely a subspecies of the Cabelline branch. It has two extra chromosomes than our normal horses, but they can reproduce to produce fertile offspring. So the Przewalski's horse, which resembles those one in those early cave paintings, there's around 2,000 of them left on the planet, and they were saved from extinction. There was roughly 12 to 16 in zoos after the Second World War, and these have been bred in captivity and then reintroduced into the wild. So those early horses that we see in Europe resembled more the Przewalski's horse than the modern Cabelline horse that we have now, which has been selectively bred really since the dawn of domestication at 3500 BC. So the horse we have now has been a lot of human manipulation to breed it to the various types and breeds of horses we have now.
Because those horses in the cave paintings and probably the ones that were first domesticated, they were much stockier, had a kind of a bigger head. They weren't as tall as the ones that we have today.
No, they were probably, if you look at modern Przewalski's horses, they come in somewhere around, 800 pounds-ish. When you compare that to the average American quarter horse, which is kind of 1,200 pounds. So they were stockier, kind of thicker set with a thick neck and they're different looking. They look more like people would think of a donkey than a horse, but they are probably just a subspecies of the modern Cabelline horse line. And as I mentioned, there's only one species of horse is currently on the planet, with the Przewalski being a subspecies.
So humanity was hunting the horse for food and for hide, and then almost devoured it out of existence. The horse had some pockets where they continued to exist, and then they were domesticated. But first, they were almost kind of ranched for their protein, and then. Then they became tamed. When did we start riding horses?
So horses evolve, actually. They're a North American creature. The epicenter of equine evolution is in the Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico area. So they evolve over 60 million years from a fox-sized creature, roughly 10 pounds, called a Hyracotherium or Dawn horse, and through survival pressures, eventually become the modern branch of Equus. Climate change is primarily the reason they go extinct across the planet. By roughly, 4000 BCE, horses have gone extinct across the planet, including the Americas. They went extinct here roughly 9 to 10,000 years ago. And again, it's climate change. It wasn't just the horse. There was 80 to 85% of large mammals went extinct in the Americas during this time period after the last ice age. Human hunting probably played a smaller role. So they're extinct all over the planet, save for a tiny pocket of the Eurasian steppe known as the Pontic-Caspian steppe above the Caspian and Black Seas in what is now Ukraine, southern Russia, and Kazakhstan. And this is where they're first domesticated for literally a livestock of meat and milk, as well as their secondary products of to make all sorts of tools and instruments, just like the indigenous peoples here with their 150 uses of every part of the bison. So they're domesticated for their meat and milk, like every other barnyard animal. And then very quickly, we realized the potential of this multi-purpose superpower animal, and quickly use it to haul wagons, to ride, to herd other animals, including sheep and goats, which is much easier on horseback. And then eventually by around 2000 BCE, we start adding the chariot to the compendium of uses of this animal.
So what would you write about it being a huge game changer for humanity and putting the early civilization on steroids, and also being able to help people move around? Transportation is always, when you have a transportation revolution, lots of things happen. So what would we, tell me what you think would have happened if horses had been devoured out of existence, or, you know, we that never happened. We lost the horse.
Well, again, it's climate change that primarily is what makes this not, it's not humans devouring horses. It's climate change that leads to their extinction. That's an important part. Humans certainly played a role in hunting them, but that's not the main cause of the extinction of horses. And as I said, 80 to 85% of large mammals after the last ice age, they just couldn't survive with the changing climate and food sources. I mean, that's a very good what if question, but I think when we look at our primary modes of transportation, sure, we had rafts and boats, but from a land point of transportation, we had our own 2 feet of bipedalism for millions of years. And then all of a sudden we have this multi-purpose animal that has the ability to make the world immeasurably smaller overnight. And it connects people in a way that hadn't been possible prior to the domestication of the horse. Distances become smaller, and it couples people, ideas, pathogens, spirituality. All the foundational building blocks of modern civilization are hauled into place by this animal upon its domestication, and it allows the world to essentially share culture, share ideas, share invention. And that is a game changer for human society, just like we have, you know, planes, trains, and automobiles now, or even the internet. The horse was all of that to its own generations following its domestication.
But so there were no horses for North and South America, and then we saw that they were reintroduced with European. But we could see how, like in Mexico, they didn't have the horse, and they had the Aztecs. And can we, does that give us an idea what life would have been like without the horse?
Well, in a way, yes. If we look at, or, you know, we can look at pre-horse, and we don't have imperial empires the way we do it across Eurasia when we get the horse. So the first, we have the Assyrians, and then the Persians, and then obviously Alexander and the Romans, and then the Mongols. All of these empires were made possible by the horse. So it allows different groups of people to conquer territory and also to hold territory. And that's one thing if we look at warfare, but generally speaking, what these empires do is they broaden our intellectual experience as human beings by making the world, as I said, a global village and immeasurably smaller, and sharing, whether it's language or DNA or spirituality, ideas, invention, are all shared by the ability of the horse to essentially get the word out. So if we look at the Americas, the horse goes extinct here roughly 9,000 years ago, along with 80 to 85% of megafauna, as mentioned, and it's reintroduced by Columbus during his second voyage. And we quickly see people from, you know, the grasslands of South America all the way to the Comanche and Lakota in the plains of the United States adopt a wholly equestrian culture. So we can see this shift in real time with what the horse does to these cultures, and it ultimately undermines them by drastically changing their socio-cultural traditions and norms, which includes the introduction of capitalism through the fur trade, the bison fur trade, the upending of egalitarian hierarchies, if you will, or lack of hierarchies, gender roles. So it actually comes back and bites the hand that feeds. It's not an uplifting.
All right, so we will.
Not an uplifting.
Yeah, well, we're going to get more into that when we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about the horse with Timothy Weingard. His book is The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity.
My foot in the stirrup, my rein in my hand. Goodbye, old pain. I'm a leaving Cheyenne. I'm a leaving
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The Horse, The Galloping History of Humanity, with Timothy Weingard. And he's the author of multiple books, previously a book on the mosquito, which you've got to read because it's incredible. But Timothy, we're talking about how the horse, when it was domesticated, became part of, people riding it, using it for horseback carriages, moving things around. But you're saying that it wasn't all good, that the horse brought some negative things as well?
Sure. I mean, other than our hands, it's the longest serving weapon system, horse and rider, in humanity. And I liken with early domestication, these Indo-European peoples who had horses and everyone else didn't, because, again, the horse was extinct across the world, save for this small pocket where they were domesticated. Now, I liken that to our modern military. I have F-35 Joint Strike Fighters and Abrams tanks, and my enemy doesn't have airplanes or tanks. So the horse brings up both the worst and the best in humanity as far as what it does and how it shapes our culture. And obviously we can't change that. We can lament the past, but it doesn't mean we can change it. So it's used as a weapon of war almost instantaneously by these Indo-European peoples who spread their DNA and language across Eurasia from Europe to India all the way to Western China. And it shows just how powerful these first generations of domesticated horses were. So as far as the Americas, when the horse is reintroduced, we often think of the Columbian Exchange, that indigenous peoples here, obviously Jared Diamond's trifecta of guns, germs, and steel had horrific repercussions on indigenous peoples. But we somehow think that the horse was a beneficial addition to the American landscape, or the landscape of the Americas, and it's actually quite the opposite. It helps lead to their subjugation once they adopt a fully equestrian culture. And obviously in America itself, the two most recognizable equestrian indigenous cultures are the Comanche on the southern plains and the Lakota Sioux on the northern plains.
And so, explain how that was brought about their downfall, because we have heard, been taught that the Comanche became a master horseman, being able to outride and outperform anyone on horseback.
And that's certainly true, and that is absolutely true. They became the horse lords of the plains, if you will, and they excelled at horsemanship. The problem is when the horse is introduced, it really undermines traditional societal structures across the plains. So it undermines egalitarian. There was no capitalism. They didn't farm or hunt for surplus prior to the horse or the arrival of Europeans. So what the horse does, it is allows indigenous peoples to harvest bison at an industrial level to supply the American fur trade. And so this introduction of capitalism in the form of fur trade creates hierarchies of power, and it upends gender roles as well. So where we had prior egalitarian societies where women were treated relatively equal, or sometimes had even matriarchal cultures across the U.S. and Canada with indigenous peoples, we see an undermining of this, and we see it becomes a wealth in horses. So the more horses you can have, the more bison you can kill for the fur trade, the more horses you can get. And given these horse wars that were going on between rival indigenous nations, some of these nations were upwards of 65 to 75% female. So fathers would essentially sell their daughters or trade them for horses. So men who had wealth and horses could have more wives to process more bison to get more horses in this cyclical pattern. And so after your first few wives, your next few wives, and some had upwards of 20 to 40 wives, they were essentially used as slave labor to process bison for the capitalist fur trade. So it ultimately creates divisions within these indigenous nations that the Canadian American governments pounce on as a tool of divide and conquer subjugation. So at their peak years, the Comanche were killing upwards of 574,000 bison a year for the fur trade. So it also helps lead to the destruction of bison populations. It's not just Euro-American hunters like Buffalo Bill that are slaughtering bison. We also see this within indigenous cultures once they adopt an equestrian culture.
Before the development of the automobile, horses were everywhere to get around all across around the world. So what was the problem with having so many horses, say, like in New York City?
We've always had our problems with our primary modes of transportation as far as pollution goes. I mean, now we have fossil fuels and greenhouse gas and emissions with the internal combustion engine. But we also had emission or pollution problems with the primary mode of transportation for horses for the past 5,500 years in the form of mountainous piles of manure and urine. So New York City in the 1890s was home to anywhere to 200,000 to 300,000 horses doing every job imaginable. And I ask readers or your audience now to liken it, take away all cars, transport trucks, pickup trucks, trains, bicycles, everything, and substitute the horse for all of those vehicles and all the jobs we use these vehicles for. So they were donating unimaginable piles of manure and accompanying disease across these urban landscapes, not just New York and Chicago and L.A., Toronto, London, but across the world in urban landscapes. And some of these piles of manure were reaching 60 feet in public parks or back alleys. And generally, they just kind of squeegeed the manure over to the side of the road, which is why we have brownstone row houses in New York City, where those steps to the first floor were designed to rise above this sea of just absolute filth.
And so what were they planning to do about that before they realized that there were going to be automobiles? They did just figure this was just something that, we'd have to live with all this horse poop.
Yeah, they obviously this is the 1890s, so this is prior to the automobile or the Model T comes out in 1908, which revolutionizes the world yet again. So they actually hold the first international conference on sanitation and urban development to try to figure out a solution to the pollution, urban pollution, and accompanying escorting disease from these horses and donkeys that are, you know, just omnipresent across urban centers. And the meeting lasts a full weekend, and they leave the meeting with absolutely no solution to the pollution problems from urban horses. And then it just gets worse and is compounded until the internal combustion engine, unseats the horse really only 100 years ago. They didn't really find a solution because horses, again, were so indispensable to the everyday lives of humanity. And from a commerce point, they were money makers and spun profit. So they were a necessary evil.
So what happened when, in the United States, the adoption of the automobile was, frantic. It was furious. It happened almost overnight. What happened to all the horses?
So the U.S. actually, it's interesting, and I talk about this in a chapter in the book, is the U.S. is a bit of an anomaly because the United States motorizes so quickly, really, prior to the First World War and then in the interwar years, compared to every other country in the world, Canada and Britain are a distant second. And it's primarily because the U.S. has a monopoly on both petroleum and steel, the twin pillars of industrialization. So the interesting part is that the infrastructure that horses used across urban centers, whether it's roads and stations and everything else, it made the adoption of the automobile fairly easy because the automobile just, rode the tails of the horse. So the infrastructure was largely already there. And the U.S., it becomes a motorized society so quickly compared to other places or other countries. And this is actually a benefit when we get into the Second World War. A lot of people don't realize that the German army was 85% reliant on horsepower when the war broke out. It was only 15% mechanized, whereas the Americans, Canadian, and British were 100% mechanized. So the horses largely go to pet food. It wasn't a nice chapter to research and write, but largely horses are made redundant and they're sold off or they're let go. And these horses are turned into kennel ration dog food and cat food. And then the wild horse herds or the feral horse herds that numbered in the millions were rounded up and ground up into pet food as well. So that's largely where these unwanted horses went.
All right, we're going to take another break. We're going to continue discussing The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity with Timothy Weingard. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the horse, and we're listening to some horse songs in our break, coming in and out of break. Tim, you can call in if you've got a question or comment about horses. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Timothy Weingard, he is the author of the new book, The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. It's interesting how much horse talk there is in our language. Many references to horses, having horse sense, horse feathers, the four horsemen. So you could say it's in our language. It's part of our culture.
Yeah, it's interesting. Some of the phrases we use, a ton of them actually come from horse or horse tackle or horses or, you know, some form of equine connection to human beings. And I title some of the chapters with some fun wordplay based around those, but whether it's champing at the bit or a parting shot, that's actually called originally a Parthian shot, where you turn around backwards on a horse and shoot backwards with the wind as the horse is galloping forward. It originally was termed a Parthian shot, which are a group of Indo-Iranians in what is now Iran and, you know, Central Asia. And it's become a parting shot where you throw a barb at somebody and then run away, essentially. So, yes, it's amazing just how ingrained horses, whether we know it or not, they're part of our English language.
Let's go to a caller, Lisa. And Lisa, you're on the air.
Great. Thank you, David. I love your show. I'm loving this particular one. I'm in my 60s, and I've been riding horses for about 25 years, so I didn't grow up riding. It's truly one of the most magical things in my life. They are the most remarkable animals, and I'm just sort of grateful and humbled every time I ride that these magnificent animals will allow me to saddle them up and ride. And it's a very, very unique relationship because this is a big, intelligent animal. But as a rider, you have to gently create authority. And so the relationship, particularly with the horse I have now, is remarkable. I can read him. He can read me. It's just such a wonderful feedback loop. It's calming, but it's something where every second I'm riding, I'm concentrating. It's not like you can just jump on and just kind of daydream your problems away. I am so anxious to get your guest book. In terms of carriage horses, I have mixed feelings. I guess my feeling is in San Antonio, it's so darn hot. But certainly, I think they contribute much. And many horses actually want to do a job or want to work. With that said, I have a retired horse who's very happy to eat grass all day long. Anyway, thank you, David. And
well, thank
I'll
you,
be
Lisa.
To...
Thank
all
you
right,
so much.
Bye.
Bye. Right, bye-bye. So the point that Lisa has about riding a horse and what a experience it is, I know you do write about that as well, about therapeutic horses. And was this – because horse, talk about why is it, what is it about the horse that allowed it to be domesticated and so it could become, we could become part of its herd?
Well, with the taming an animal is not domesticating a species. So, you know, we saw with Hannibal, the Carthaginian general, he had tamed elephants that crossed the Alps and into, you know, invade Rome. We have, you know, Coco the gorilla, who's tame. But taming any animal is possible when you remove an infant or a young animal from the collective or their parents. Now, domesticating a species is a whole different ballgame. Most animals simply either don't want to be domesticated or don't have the right traits biologically or socially or mentally to be domesticated. And with our wonderful curiosity and our human just because anti-logic, we've tried to domesticate every animal out there. But obviously, you know, bears, for example, you can tame one bear, but you can't domesticate grizzly bears. They're just not made for that. So the horse is unique in that with human contact, it's essentially a version of a barnyard Stockholm syndrome almost. The horse gets from us something that it wants or it would get in the natural environment, and obviously we take from it. So it's a symbiotic relationship that works for both species. And when we think about the horse, obviously it's an organic animal, but we have to think of it as a living machine. And it reaches the pinnacle of essentially biotechnology, because just like when we upgrade apps on our phone, we upgrade our cars, we upgrade our trucks, we add all these extra amendments to machines, we do the same to the horse, whether that's saddles, stirrups, the horse collar eventually for drawing its weight more streamlined towards whatever it's towing, whether that be a wagon or a plow or a chariot. So we continuously upgrade armor. We continuously upgrade the horse with human amendments, and that includes selective breeding, to make it this pinnacle of biotechnology and the most powerful living machine ever invented by humanity. And we form this very centurion pact, or it elevates the capabilities of our species, both literally and figuratively, when we begin to use it in these capacities.
So what does the future of the horse look like? Will it just be, a pet?
I don't think so. I mean, we have such a strong bond and a strong relationship forged with this animal for 5,500 years. And it's so much a part of our human experience and human journey. Often we blithely overlook this because horses are just so omnipresent in all our TV shows and movies and in our Ford Mustang, all the cars and our mascots of sports teams like the Denver Broncos or the Colts, or I can go on and on. I think it's just changing its role. Certainly, you know, just watching the Olympics with the equestrian events, and we use it in sport, whether that's rodeos, recreational sport, equestrian horse racing, which I know has come under fire recently. But we're starting to see it used, as you mentioned earlier, David, with equine therapy for veterans or anybody who suffered trauma, at-risk children. We're using it. Wild horses are taken off the range to be tamed and then adopted out by inmates, and called the Wild Horse Inmate Program. We have one here in Colorado, which we see recidivism rates drastically drop when these inmates are taught to tame these horses for adoption. We still use horses in the military. There's still true cavalry units in the U.S. military, the Canadian military, the Chinese military, to patrol inaccessible frontiers. And certainly we still use them in police forces for riot and crowd control. And the statistics are remarkable at how well horses work over mounted police officer, or sorry, police officers on foot or police officers on bicycles. Mounted police officers drastically reduce violence and have a huge impact on quelling or, you know, reducing the chances of riot. And it's simply because of our innate relationship with the horse. Humans love horses. Unfortunately, humans will have no issue hurting the human officer, but they don't want to hurt the equine officer that they're riding. And at the same time, they have a healthy fear of horses because they're so big. And their unique blend of size, speed, strength, and stamina that they give the horse distance. So they're remarkable in their use by police forces.
Well, since we've had genetics and archaeology and all these other discoveries, we have a better understanding of the horse. And you talked about how climate change, you know, we almost lost the horse completely and all those things. But during this long period, when we had horses and they were a huge part of humanity during the golden age of the horse, did we understand those things? Did we know where the horse came from? Was there a thought that the horse had always been what it is today?
Yeah, the common perception really up until, you know, around the American Civil War, the 1860s and into the 1870s and 80s, when fossil hunting and you know, bone collecting becomes a academic pastime and a social pastime for that matter. It was always thought that horses evolved in Eurasia, on the grasslands of Eurasia and what is, you know, Mongolia, Ukraine, Russia, Kazakhstan. And that's simply not true. We know now they're a North American animal, and, you know, they were gifted themselves to the rest of the world. Now they do die off here, as mentioned. But the epicenter of equine evolution is in, you know, this region of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah. And we have a better idea now with archaeology, advancements in dating, and certainly the rise of DNA testing is giving us a better map of the who, what, where, and when of horse extinction across the planet, and then of domestication and the spread of horses upon domestication.
And learning that, we have a better understanding of how civilization developed.
Yes, and then by extension, we can see the impact, the unrivaled impact of horses upon domestication on, you know, the human experience, or the, you know, the advancement, I don't like the word, not advancement in many ways, of civilization, and just the again, unrivaled game-changing impact that this one creature had on our historic journey as human beings. The history of humanity is inseparable from the history of the horse, and that's really what the book is about. It's a history book kind of delving into those game-changing impacts.
Timothy Weingard is the author of 6 books. His latest, The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. Timothy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening.